The Board of Education regular meeting will now come to order. Mr. Ellis, will you lead us in the pledge?
Of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mrs. Tucker, roll call, please.
Mr. Ellis?
Here.
Mr. Kenworth?
Here.
Mr. Bondurant?
Here.
Smith?
Here.
Mrs. Howard? Mr. Black?
Here.
Mrs. Nelson?
Here. Are there any members of the public present who wish to address the board at this time?
We do have one group that wishes to present the board to the board at this time, and it's a special group. We every once in a while have a group from the community who wishes to share a message with the Board of Education, and we allow them some time during our public participation. And this evening, I'd like to introduce Bryce DeBosch, a former student of District 41, and he and a group of associates did a mission trip this summer in Rwanda and had an opportunity to experience the educational system there and felt as if the treasures, the insights that they gained would be worth sharing with us. And so we invited them to do a presentation, and we have allowed them a little bit longer than our typical 3 minutes to do so. So, Bryce, I'll let you introduce your team, and we welcome you to share tonight.
All right, I'm Bryce DeBosch. I'm 16. I'm going to be a junior at Glenbard West. I went to Churchill Elementary School, and I went to Rwanda to learn about the cultural experience and then also just to help people.
Hello, my name is Dominic Capoli. I'm 17 years old. I'm going to be a senior at Glenbard West. I went to Lincoln Elementary School, and I definitely went to Rwanda to help gain a better experience and kind of like a view of the world and also be able to help people.
I'm Lindsay Coleman. I'm 17 and going to be a senior at Glenbard West. I went to Ben Franklin Elementary School, and I went to Rwanda to experience a culture not of excess, but with people that cherish everything they have.
I'm Emily Gores. I'm 17 and a senior at Glenbard West, and I went to Rwanda to see the other side of the refugee highway.
We would like to thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight to share with you the experience that our youth group has had this summer in going to Rwanda. This was a great experience in which we learned to develop relationships with people from another culture, learned about that culture, and worked to meet some of the needs that we saw. Along the way, we learned much about education, as well as several other issues, including AIDS, refugees, and the need for clean water for sustained life. We also learned about the Rwandan genocide and the peace and reconciliation that has happened since then. Tonight, we're going to share with you what we learned about Rwanda and how that has affected us. To begin, Lindsay's going to share with you some basic information about the educational system in Rwanda.
In Rwanda, they have kindergarten, primary school, secondary school, and university. Primary school is equivalent to elementary school and middle school, but due to overcrowding, they have a shortened day, half day, but they're still expected to learn the entire school year's worth of knowledge during the school year. And the children wear uniforms to school, and this is often their best outfit that they have, and unfortunately, families are responsible for paying the school fees that cover the books and the uniforms. However, many people who make less than $1 a day are not able to cover these small fees, and therefore their children cannot attend school. Secondary school in Rwanda is equivalent to high school here, but boarding schools are the norm for secondary schools. After ending secondary school, many students hope to attend university. The reason for this is that university graduates are highly respected among Rwandan culture. In order to get a good job in America, you generally need a sufficient high school and college education. But in Rwanda, students with undergraduate degrees are working jobs like waitering. In order to have a high-paying job, you have to have a master's degree at the very least. Education really determines the job that a Rwandan might get.
In addition to learning about the educational system in Rwanda, while there, we also had the chance to observe and learn about the education in refugee camps, places where those running from their lives seek refuge. And Emily is going to share with you about that.
The educational system of the refugee camp allows students access to education up to P9, which is the equivalent of 8th grade here. There is no high school option in the camp, which really affects the lives of the students. Without having a full day of school, these 14-year-olds and above are on their own for the whole day. We were told that with nothing to do during the day, these teenagers will often participate in drugs and violence. Fortunately, there is a small opportunity for the brightest students to be sent to boarding school. However, this can only happen if money is sent for their tuition. This is something that we are really looking forward to working on as a church community.
The more we learned about Rwanda, the more needs became apparent. And so Bryce is going to share with you about that.
Some of the needs we saw in the Rwandan educational system were supplies ranging from pencils to computers. Money is also a major need when it comes to education in Rwanda. We met orphans living on the street who were forced from their homes at an early age due to poverty. Once on the street, they had many difficulties, including obtaining the money required for school fees and therefore an education. A local church provided some of these kids with the basic math and English. As Emily said, there is also a need for more education in the Kaziba refugee camp because the UN only supports them through the 8th grade. In order to support both the refugees and the street kids, we can send money to International Teams, an organization dedicated to meeting the needs of widows, refugees, and orphans. International Teams then uses that money to cover the school fees of street kids and to send the top academic kids in the refugee camp to boarding school so that they can finish high school.
Despite the difficulty of obtaining an education, education is really valued by Rwandans because it opens every door for them. In Rwanda, without an education, there is almost no way to get out of poverty. Rwandans understand the huge influence education can have on their lives, and that's why it's so important to them. Because of this, after our mission trip, I definitely value my education more. I realize that most Americans take their school for granted, but now I understand that I need to be thankful for the opportunities that I'm given, especially as I begin to apply for colleges. Also, I know that I must make the most of my opportunities, even though I'm so fortunate to have them.
I also value the expensiveness of our education and all the opportunities we have. I realize now that I should take advantage of these great opportunities and work hard to achieve success for my future.
After being in Rwanda, I have realized how many great opportunities we have at our school and how little we have to pay to get an amazing education.
Education is such a privilege that we are given here in America that we don't really think much about. Having a good education gives us so many opportunities and helps us form a stable future. After being in Rwanda, I appreciate that all kids in America get access to school through high school, which in turn gives students a chance at a good job or further education.
We would like to thank you for giving us this chance to share our experience with you. And now we'd like to ask if you guys have any questions.
Where on the African continent is Rwanda located?
Rwanda's central eastern, directly east of the Congo.
Okay. Was it colonized by the European country?
Yes.
Which one?
Belgium and then France.
Okay.
So some of you guys speak French?
There was one girl on our team, a sophomore in the South, and she spoke French.
What was the water source that the school provided to the students?
In the refugee camp, there was a water pump in the camp, but it was kind of every camp was themselves. They didn't really get water
access.
Emily, you mentioned that part of your interest in going was to see, I think you phrased it, the other side of the refugee highway.
Yeah.
So you attended Ben Franklin.
I went to
Lincoln. Okay. So could you equate any of your experience with students who were refugees in Lincoln at the time? This was quite a few years ago, so I'm not sure if the population was as significant as it is, but is there any connection for you with that?
Yeah, there actually is. At our church at St. Lutheran, we run the ESL program, and we have a kids club for the kids there. So prior to the trip, before the trip even came up, I was involved with that. So working with those kids is something that always interested me. And I went to Rwanda. I saw them coming to the country and their families struggling. But now seeing where they came from, I think gives it a different depth. There's more depth to it.
it. There's much more problems than people see when they first look. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a chance to work with other students your age, Rwandan students? You know, were you working jointly, hand in hand, or on a project?
We spent one day with street kids, and when we heard the idea of street kids, we thought much younger, but we were informed that most of the kids were somewhere between the age of 16 and like 20. Mm-hmm. And so when we spent the day with them, they were all kids who were either trying to go to school or had finished school as far as the school level. But so we got a chance to talk to them and just kind of see what like their education was like, and we let them ask us questions as well as we asked them.
We also had somebody who lived down from where we stayed, Eugene. He played soccer with us a few times when we had a little bit of free time, and actually he's Facebook friends with all of us.
So there's some internet access.
You talk a lot about culture. You guys are kids, you got your PS3s, your longboards, your soccer games, all those wonderful gadgets. What's it like being a kid in Rwanda? What was your impression? What's it like?
Well, there's a lot of, school is very important to everyone who can attend it. There's also the kids who can't always attend it, you have to go and get water. That's one of the things we did. Walk 2 miles to get water and then climb back up the giant hill. There's also a lot of soccer, which is very fun to play, and then volleyball. Just things that they do in their free time.
Yeah, I know. When we were there, I felt like one of the bigger things with their kids, I felt like family and community. So, they don't have, easy ways to get transported a lot of the time. So I felt like we'd go and we'd see them there, and we'd be they'd be spending time with their other siblings or with their friends, and even their parents, which is something I think we don't do enough here. I feel like it's so much connected to electronics, but I felt like their life was definitely they valued it a lot more than we do. But I felt like it was a lot harder. I thought if I was in their shoes, I would be why? I feel it's so unfair. But they felt so grateful for what they did have.
Did they have any misconceptions of what it's like to grow up in the U.S. and their thoughts of where Chicago was, or did they have any idea in the U.S. what that meant? Or?
Yes, they knew what America was. They asked us what our motherland was. Uh-huh. That was their question. And so some of the ones who went to they knew where Illinois was as a state. But I think one of the biggest misconceptions when we got to talk to them was they have the idea that everyone is very wealthy and are extremely obsessed with rap. Any questions about piercings, tattoos, and what does this mean?
And how did you describe that?
Well, Doug had said that the people who do this is people who can't dance. That's probably the best answer we could have given.
That's great. Any other questions? I just want to thank you for putting such thought into your reflections and your words, because we have in our school community, in our district, so many children that come from refugee situations, and so to be on that other side of the highway, as you said, I think really informs some of your appreciation, what you can do as young people to impact that in a positive way, which you've already been doing, and I just think it's great for us as stewards, as board members, to hear that message and be reminded of that as well. So thank you for giving up part of your second to the last day before school starts. And to the parents that are here, thank you very much for your support of your children and for having them come and speak with us, and to your youth director as well and her husband for the time that you put into this. We really appreciate it. It was a wonderful article in the Herald about the trip as well, so we look forward to more of it. So have a great academic year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, guys. Have a great night.
It's great to see former students so articulate and mature and
exciting. Yeah, really neat. Are some of those former students of yours?
No.
Okay. Great. You're welcome. Glad that you come. All right. Presentations, reports, and initiative updates. There are none scheduled for tonight's meeting, so we'll go to action items. The consent agenda. Are there any items board members would like removed from the consent agenda to be considered separately? Hearing none, may have a motion to approve the consent agenda as presented, which includes human resources, personnel report, employment recommendations, internal transfers, and resignations. Number two, finance, facilities, and operations, including the treasurer's report, investment schedule, monthly revenue, expenditure summary report, a summary of bills and payroll, school district payment order, vandalism damage report, the disposal of surplus property, and the 2011-2012 FOIA report. Other matters, including board meeting minutes, August 8, 2011, the public hearing and regular meeting, and an August 8 closed session, the semi-annual review of closed meeting minutes, and the destruction of closed meeting audio recordings.
Motion.
Second.
Roll call, please.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mr. Kenworth?
Yes.
Mr. Vondra?
Yes.
Howard?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Howard? Yes. Yes. Superintendent's recommendations. The telephone service recommendation, at its August 8th meeting, regular meeting, the board discussed the administration's recommendation to move the district's phone services from AT&T to Call One for a period of 3 years with an estimated annual cost of $47,797.20. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented?
Motion. Second.
Discussion?
I just would like to make one comment, and I know when Bob spoke to the board during discussion in finance about AT&T and that we had not had any contact from AT&T. I do want to let you know that we finally received a phone call from AT&T last week, midweek, and Bob was not at his desk, so he was unable to answer the phone. Took the message, returned the call, and we have not heard back from them since then. So unless the board has an interest in us pursuing AT&T, I mean, we wanted to let you know that, we did finally make contact with them, mm-hmm. but we are comfortable still moving forward with the recommendation as presented. We just wanted you to be aware that, we did finally get some effort on their part.
So the dollar charge that we pay currently to AT&T, is that a continuation of an old contract? Or is that a...
The contract is a number of years old, and it just is, we don't have an existing contract with them now. It's just sort of the rates they implemented and move forward. It's on a month-to-month basis, the agreement fits in place now.
So the dollar...
No formalizing.
But so the dollar would have been part of an old contract.
Any other questions? Discussion? Okay. Roll call, please.
Mr. Kenworth? I'm sorry. Mr. Kenworth?
Yes.
Mr. Bondra?
Yes.
Mrs. Howard?
Yes.
Mr. Black?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes. On to the superintendent's report.
I wanted to let you know, first I would like to tell you that teachers have been engaged in professional development for the last 3 days now, and we had a presenter by the name of Tom Maney with us last week for 2 days. Dr. Maney is a retired superintendent from Kildare District, referred to as our twin, because the demographics are so similar to ours, and he presented and worked with the staff of the first 2 days of our institutes on deepening our work with our professional learning communities, and so we felt like those were really successful 2 days. Today, people were in their buildings working on PBIS, the full implementation of that, as well as the anti-bullying work that will be kicked off this year, and then again, going back to their learning teams or their grade level teams to talk further about implementation of the professional learning community. Tomorrow, after our breakfast and brief time together, people will go back to their buildings and probably have a little bit more of a nuts and bolts day, as well as continuing their work on school improvement. But good start so far. As always, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of chatter, and a lot of happy people to see each other again. The other thing I wanted to report on is choice. We concluded this afternoon around 4 o'clock at the close of business day any requests that had been made to change schools. And when all was said and done, we had 18 students who did request a transfer. And those transfers have been divided between Forest Glen and Ben Franklin. And I can give you a little bit more insight. It actually, we broke it down evenly between the two schools. It was 9 students going to each of those schools. We had a little bit of a challenge in second grade because our second grade numbers are already high across the district. And so to try to find spaces where anyone could go, but we were able to do that and keep our class size targets, you know, relatively intact. The areas where we are over a little bit, which we were over anyway, second grade at Lincoln, we added no students because they were already over their target at 23.25, and we added no students to Lincoln at grade 5 because they were already over their target at 27.75. At Franklin, we added 2 students in kindergarten, 1 student in first grade, 1 student in second grade, 1 student in third grade, 3 students in fourth grade, and 1 student in fifth grade. And nobody moved out of the target at Franklin. At Forest Glen, we added 2 students at kindergarten. We added 2 students at second grade, and it takes them above the target, just 0.25. We added 1 student at third grade, and we added 1 student, or 3 students, I'm sorry, at fifth grade. And fourth grade was already above the target, so we added no students there.
But did Churchill fall below targets?
Churchill's targets are at kindergarten, 19.2, at first grade, 21.3, at third grade, I'm just trying to make sure I'm going across it the right way, at third grade, 20.20, and at fourth and fifth, they're below target at 19 and at 20.
And are any of those fourth and fifths, though, was that already going to be an issue because
we added a section.
So they might have been right.
They would have been low anyway.
Well, it's under 20 for fourth and fifth grade. It's really low.
Especially then when you look at other schools that are at the top end of that target.
Correct.
And the kids that, the children and families that exercised their choice, were they, can you tell us if they are, would they be students who were in the groups that did not make AYP?
One student was in the group that did not make AYP. All of the other students were representative, but did not fall in the category. And some of them, you can't tell whether they made AYP because they're not in the testing group yet.
Right, the younger.
Right, so up to grades three, current grade three, we have no, other than math, we didn't have any ISAT results to be able to say. Mm-hmm. We did have some second language students who are in our ELL program take advantage of choice, so you would say that in the subgroup that did not make AYP, there were students who chose to go to another school.
But that was one, just one?
I don't have, no, there was more than, there were probably about 4 or 5 students who
from the subgroup.
Now, second language subgroup.
And a couple things I just want to mention about this. I had an opportunity, you know, like all of us, people have been asking, you know, questions in a lot of the other schools where trying to understand what the impact was. And it's been, you know, trying to send them to those of you who actually have answers. But one of the things that I think has been interesting is that the support for Churchill School and Scott Clausewitz and his staff was still overwhelming. And I think it's important to note that while we recognize that the governmental label of not making adequate yearly progress has been given to that school, it is an unfair assessment of those students, and it's an insult, in my opinion, to the staff and the leadership at that school that they would be given a governmental rating of that. Mm-hmm. To ask children who do not speak the language to take a test that they can't read because they don't read that language is patently unfair, and then to give them a label that they aren't making progress, I think is unfair. I think it's disappointing that this is what happened. So my next question is, what are we going to do to make sure this doesn't happen to them again? And how long does it take to get them off that list? Because it's not reflective of what goes on in that building.
Well, it takes 2 years. You have to demonstrate under the current law.
Right. Hopefully it won't. Right.
Under the current law, you would have to demonstrate for 2 consecutive years that you make AYP. My guess is that to make the leap from, each of the groups are a little bit different, but to make a 40 percentile leap or a 30 percentile leap might be a bit much, mm-hmm, for 1 year. And so if the law is still in place, even if we made AYP next year, we would still be. And next year the mark is 22.5%.
And so,
I say 92.5?
You said 20.
I thought I did. I'm sorry. So 92.5.
Okay.
I don't know where that came from.
Well, but one of the questions that I think, people ask are, do the people who've chosen to, do these choices then, is it every year at the school, with a possibility? And then I think, the community and people in general need to understand, while we all sit and say that this process is not a good one, it doesn't really reflect what's going on in the building, I think our district unfortunately may be the victim of watching it unfold its unintended purposes, because then you're just really moving children around, and the demographics at each school are such that I think services for the children that need them aren't necessarily there because the demographics of that individual school. So we're really not doing what's best for kids. Yet we're not allowed to, and understandably so, place kids based on certain needs. You can't put them all in one school or in certain buildings or whatever. And I just think, I'm not suggesting that we would do that, but what concerns me is, are we just shifting kids around because of this? And Churchill has the ability to meet the needs of these kids for their services, and now are we moving them into buildings that don't have full-time ELL people or full-time people to meet some of those needs?
Well, we do have full-time ELL people in all of our schools. If a child receives self-contained bilingual,
we only have
that at Churchill.
Well, that's my question. Did anyone leave a bilingual classroom at Churchill to go to another school where they're going to get pulled out now for ELL instruction? And that parents thought that was a better...
Well, the parent was communicated with on at least 3 occasions in Spanish, and finally made the decision that they made.
When will we know what the financial impact is in terms of busing? We're adding extra bus routes to just...
Probably one bus route.
One bus route?
I mean, we have to.
That will
that's
just
what
pick
we'll
up
be.
These students and stop at the they're not the schools that is up are outside of their normal attendance area.
That they can't walk to. Say that again, Steve. I'm not sure I understood.
Well, I'm just saying these are students who are normally in the Churchill attendance area.
Correct.
That would have been bused to Churchill.
Maybe or walked.
Or walked. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to have a bus route that's going to pick them up and drop them off at Forest Glen and Lincoln.
Correct.
And Ben.
Correct. So we'll know if it's one bus once we do an analysis of the time, because you can't keep children on a bus, too long. So we would presume that because there's only 18 children, some of whom come from the same family, that we'll be able to do a route in a relatively short period of time.
If they were in the Churchill attendance area, but they fit into the still into the Forest Glen walking distance.
They do not receive transportation.
Okay.
And they got to choose which school they were going to attend?
Well, choice was based on available space. And in our, I believe you all received a copy of the letter.
Right.
On the form, it identified grade levels that were open. The only time, the only place we made a change was at second grade, because the number of students requesting second grade was larger than, the impact would have been so large on Forest Glen alone, that we, Forest Glen, by today's date, Forest Glen and Ben Franklin had the exact same ratio of students at 21.75.
Well, I attended the meeting at Churchill. Mm-hmm. I think we spoke for about an hour, and there was a translator, so you had to speak one or two sentences at a time. I mean, if you didn't know anything about what was going on, I don't see how you could really become educated on all the issues in an hour that, like that. I mean, I hope people asked a lot more questions. And my impression, just of some of the questions that were asked, focused a lot on what Churchill's going to do, how they get there, and things like that, which I think is a bit unfair. And I don't know if you had time to really explain that whatever's going to happen at Churchill in the coming year is going to happen at every school, because the bar gets raised at every school, that there was no, well, Churchill's going to be under this microscope, we'll just go to another school and it's not going to be the same way. Every school is going to have to do the same thing that's going on at Churchill. And
I think we spoke to almost every family that was on that list. And there were a lot of phone inquiries, a lot of email inquiries, back and forth over the last several days. And well, I think you're absolutely right. A meeting doesn't answer all your questions. And as you see, I mean, 18 students out of 600 plus students.
Well, and there was really
not a very large.
You know, the data that was used to, you know, come to the conclusion that Churchill didn't make AYP under the legislation, you weren't able to present all the data in the other schools to show where those subgroups were testing. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that it may have been the same at Churchill. Churchill just had percentage-wise more students. Mm-hmm. that school actually fell under AYP.
Right, right.
Where we'd be compared to other districts or other schools. I mean, even like District 89, none of their schools are big enough to have any subgroups. Mm-hmm. That they could have exactly the same testing ratios that we do, but none of their schools are labeled AYP because they're smaller.
Well, it's the same thing with West and South. I mean, that's my point, Steve, is that it's an unfair label that's really not necessarily reflective of our school communities at any of our buildings, because you don't have enough kids to make a subgroup.
Right. Is this group still, with the children moving out, are they still considered in the Churchill subgroup, or are they now part of the new school?
Mm-hmm. The new school.
So did we fall now underneath that magic 45?
It's hard to say if we will at any grade level. You have to be in the testing grade level. So it has to be grades 3 through 5 that you have 45 students in any one of the subgroups. And, of course, we all have one subgroup. So I just want to make that
right,
clear.
Right, no, I understand. I understand.
The subgroups are not just everyone, but mm-hmm. The sub, you know, all students are included in a subgroup of some sort.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the reason Churchill got the choice that there are still schools is because of the Title I funds?
The two reasons. Hadley has been identified as in school improvement as well at the state level, but because they don't receive Title I dollars, they don't have to offer choice. What they have to do is submit their school improvement plan to the state. It has to be approved and read, and you become eligible for some extra support services, system of support dollars. Our elementary schools, Churchill is the only school to report any subgroup other than white students. So while there are other students, they just don't number 45. So that's why those schools are not identified in status of any sort. If you receive federal dollars, Title I, then you go into the federal status as well as the state status. So Churchill has kind of a double whammy. One, numbers of students that comprise subgroups other than white students, and two, they do receive federal dollars for low-income students. Lincoln also receives federal dollars, at least for this year, for low-income students, but Lincoln has not had a reporting subgroup yet, besides white students.
Do you have... So I guess I'm just saying, you know, if you refuse the Title I dollars, does that affect the requirement to move the students?
It would, technically, and several school districts have explored that. I've explored that in the past, and back in the early part of No Child Left Behind, when schools began to start to experience the not making adequate yearly progress, they explored saying, "Just I just don't want any of your Title money." But then the law was amended to include students with IEPs. And, I mean, it always included students with IEPs, but it started to tie funds to students with IEPs. And so if you didn't take your federal dollars, your Title dollars, you also would lose your IDEA dollars. That's a large chunk of money. So while some school districts felt they could give up their Title dollars, when it came to the special ed reimbursements, they said, whoa, too much money. Mm-hmm. So the game, you know, the feds caught on to that game real quickly and amended the law. So I don't know of any district that has refused federal dollars.
If you only had one junior high and it was an AYP, do you have to offer choice to another district?
Yes, you have to. What you have to do?
You have to request.
You have to request. We receive requests each year from other junior highs around our neighboring DuPage, asking whether or not we have the ability to house students from their district as part of choice. And of course, we have. How many portables at Hadley? So we do not ever indicate that we have room.
Right. Another hypothetical. What if every school in the district was under AYP? Do you effectively have open enrollment? What if, like, if there are only two in AYP, do you only have choice to the non-AYP?
Correct.
Or do you still, okay. But what if every school is AYP?
Then you have to ask other districts if they would allow your choice.
But you don't have to basically allow within district.
You wouldn't.
Well, I'm just saying.
If you follow the kind of the philosophy of
the law.
Well,
I understand the philosophy. I'm just wondering what the actual legislation says. And, you know,
so if the other districts
have choice, no matter what. If
the other districts say no, then they can't.
You have no choice. You have no choice.
But if every school was under AYP, you just set your normal attendance boundaries. There would be no choice.
Right. But that would be a school district where every school receives Title dollars, Title I dollars.
Okay, so you can never get there if you don't have every school.
And you can't limit the choice. I mean, the choice has to be open to any grade level. It's not just testing grade levels.
No, the law says you have to offer to all students in that school. The law is very, very specific with almost no caveats for exception.
So do you guys think this will be around next year?
Well, I would say that the federal agenda is pretty heavy, so whether or not they get around to reauthorizing is questionable. There has been the president and the secretary of education have proposed a waiver to states. We don't have any information about Illinois and that waiver at this point. So I really, you know, I hate to make a guess at that because I just don't know whether they'll wait till 2014 when the law expires.
There is a congressional subcommittee that's been called to review the law, but that what I read is that it's going to go into the fall. So there's not going to be any changes, you know, before the end of the year.
At some point it goes to 100%. Right.
2014.
So every school will be a choice school by then.
Well, every school will be in school improvement status. You only have to offer choice if you receive federal dollars. And some districts receive very few federal dollars. So a district very similar to ours might have one, two schools that are receiving federal Title I dollars, which are dollars targeted towards your low-income students. Some districts don't, you know, perhaps even have a enough low-income students to generate Title I dollars, or very few of them.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like the low-income, the Title I dollars aren't the issue. It's the tie-in to the IDEA money that we can't most districts can't afford to
lose. Well, the issue,
how would you opt out of that?
The issue is that if you receive Title I dollars, you fall under the federal requirements of No Child Left Behind.
Right.
And you can't parse
those. You can't parse them out. Right.
Ann had put an article in our Thursday letter a couple, I think two Thursday letters ago, about the state of Montana and South Dakota and what was the third one? I can't remember, Colorado maybe. Anyway, that they, or Utah. They were exploring getting out of that. It was a good article. And I think, you know, the what resonated for me is when I went back to reread it when we were notified about Churchill, that what their school board members who were quoted were saying and their state board of education leadership is that it's a, you know, it's this broad brush. And so, you know, I think from what I heard from some of you as we, you know, had some conversation one-to-one about this, are you getting a call and that type of thing, that we were all very good about, you know, moving people to the, you know, to the district office to answer questions, but we were all educated enough that we could explain, you know, here's one lens to have on this versus the word failure, which I think none of us believe is accurate. So I want to thank the board members for being willing to reach out and, you know, answer questions, and certainly to Ann and her staff for spending you know, time individually and multiple times with parents. So we're going to have to see how the year goes.
And I want to express my appreciation to those of you who sent emails to Scott extending your support to him, which meant a lot.
Well, and Ann, if we could, you know, I think sometimes for us, again, you know, we get information so we understand a little bit more than the average person about how this works. And any kind of little, you know, blurb, link, or whatever that we could help carry on our website, because I think that's a point. We do not see us as a failure, and I think that's the label that you feel that the school, and in some way the district then receives, is we failed, we didn't make adequate, you know, we didn't score high enough. And again, it's an unfair label, but when you understand a little bit more about the program and you understand how it works, you start to, you get it.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, this is just silly. This is not really reality, but okay. And you can move on from that. And I just don't think that, you know, there's not enough out there for people to understand how this really works and the impact it really has.
Mm-hmm.
And why we can't just say, well, we don't care. We really don't get that much federal funding to begin with. They never pay us. And so let's just skip it.
Feds
pay. I take that back.
A little
bit. Feds do pay. But you can't get out of this, and why that would be.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, anything that we can put out there to help people understand a little bit more, what does this really mean, I think would be helpful.
And that question was raised on Thursday, and you did answer it.
But I think it needs to go out to the other schools, because while the focus is on Churchill, this other schools, especially the ones who are, you know, receiving more students, they need to understand what this means and the impact it's had, you know. Because in our buildings, I think a little less of Forest Glen, but our other building, you know, we are at maximum capacity. So every extra little body taxes the entire school. So people want to know and need to know how to better way to understand this.
I mean, understanding is one thing, but what if you look on the other side of the coin and ask, you know, what is a solution to bring this back into revenue? I mean, is that the next step? Is, you know, here's a scenario, we have to throw, you know, 50 more specialists or something. So, I mean, what are we going to see?
We think we have the resources, and one of the reasons we have been doing the work that we've been doing around our professional learning communities is that it is about getting laser focused around results and what students are doing and how they're doing, whether they're performing at high levels or whether they're struggling, and being able to, you know, take that apart and meet the needs of all of those students. We're in the pyramids of intervention, which are the tiered look at how students are performing and what they need, and being able to target at each of those areas
get those students the specific interventions that they need. You know, we've added PBIS, which is kind of the social piece of that pyramid of intervention. So making sure that we create the environments in which students can be successful. These are the kinds of things that are being done across the nation to close the achievement gap. It has to be student by student. You know, so we can add 10 more resources, but with good instruction, good strategies, the right combination of all of those things, we'll see students' achievements rise. I mean, we have appropriate supports for second language students. We have appropriate supports for our special needs students. We have appropriate supports for, you know, students who are struggling for enrichment. So it really is about keeping at the work that we're doing. There is no program. There is no magic bullet. It really is about meeting each student where he or she is and having good data to be able to say, here's how this child is learning, here's what this child needs. You know, and part of the work that was done in the Institute days is that it's difficult work and it cannot be done alone. It cannot be done in isolation of other colleagues. It's just too difficult. And so we need all kind of all hands, all minds on deck to figure out ways in which we meet the needs of varying abilities of students.
So to sum it up, there's nothing else we need to report?
Not at this point. Not at this point. I mean, we've added summer school. We'll be sharing that data with you. We're not sure that's the right approach either. So it may be that we'll be looking at using those resources for a different purpose.
We talk of our goals and around kids improving every year. Do we know these kids, even though they're AYP, did they improve?
Yes, they did.
Every single one.
Well, you're asking me if I know every single student. Our subgroups all improved last year.
Two questions. Are you saying the actual child?
Yeah, I'm talking about the children.
Versus the grade level test from year to year.
I couldn't tell you did every single child improve last year. I mean, I just don't have that kind of detailed information in my head. But our overall scores improved. In all of our subgroups, and our percentage of students who met their growth targets grew last year in all of our subgroups. And even taking that data a little bit more specifically, we would have to say, well, those who didn't make their growth targets still grew, but how much did they grow? How close were they to getting there? And I couldn't certainly discuss that with any kind of accuracy with the board.
But that's what's so frustrating, because you give these kids a label that they failed, but they didn't fail. They improved that, and that's what they're here. Just frustrating.
And we see this as an opportunity to improve, to become more focused, to become more data understanding, you know, using the right data, developing common assessments. We see this as an opportunity and aligned with the direction that we're headed. It's, you know, with every unfortunate step, there's an opportunity, and we believe that we want to be optimistic and look at this as a learning opportunity for all of us.
Mm-hmm. I just want to make one quick another question. Go ahead.
I want to make sure I understood that. So last year we knew exactly which kids did not meet AYP.
Mm-hmm.
This year we know which kids. Our analytics at this point can't tell us that.
Did every kid make progress?
That they made progress.
I'm not saying they can't. I'm saying I can't tell you
can't tell
right now off the top of my head. I think it would be a guess for me to say every single student in this district made progress.
But we have the analytics.
We do.
Map scores,
we absolutely have it. We have our MAP scores. We have the IHAT data for us is not that kind of data. It's district data. We look at it at a broader level. We have common assessments. But certainly we have our MAP data, which we do at least twice a year for students, so we'd be able to say, did every student grow?
Mm-hmm. Just a quick comment to close this. I met with Ann this morning to review the agenda. And I was out of town on Thursday. I was glad that Steve could go. Who else was able to go over to church? Anybody else? Just Steve? Thanks for attending. But Ann did mention that after the meeting was over and kind of walking out, there was a kind of a final comment from a couple of parents who said to her, this is both parent and school, and, you know, it's 50-50. You've done, you're at least your 50, if not more. We have to do ours. And so I think that that's a really important message to resonate for certainly us as the board, because we work really hard on parent engagement and a verbal, you know, kind of visceral recognition that there's really critical partnerships for parents to make. So I'm really, you know, energized by that. You know, it's a subpopulation of a subset, but at least they made the comment verbally and wanted to make that connection. So I think that's important for us to take to account as well. They're, you know, part of it. So thank you. Is that it?
Okay.
Board reports. Any board members that have a report to offer tonight?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say, being at Hadley the last couple weeks, and you know they were finishing up, and I happened to be there today. It is incredible. Thank you guys for supporting building it. These kids. I just listening to their chat.
For the idea.
Thank you, John, for pressing the issue and making them do it better than it was, because it's awesome. And the kids are all walking by. They can't wait to go out there. They just. It's just so cool.
So, Tara, what, for those of us who can't see, what are you talking about?
So, this is a picture they had in courtyard. So on our they had a courtyard in their performance area, and just to look out a window and see green grass and being able to see people and being able to utilize the space, I just think it's going to be invaluable. I mean, listening to the kids talk about it was interesting, because you know you really always wonder, do they even pay attention? I mean, they're just walking down the halls or they're doing it, and I, you know, one of the students I overheard make a comment. You know, oh my gosh, I hope my theater class goes out that. Look at that stage. Oh, look at that pond. I wish, you know, eighth graders, God, I hope we get to do, you know, that was really cool last year when we did the water thing. And, you know, just, it was interesting to hear them talk about it. And even just to be able to walk outside, you know, when they don't have recess anymore, just to be able to walk outside and get fresh air, it looks great. I mean, I'm just really excited that after all these years, it was finally done.
Mm-hmm.
And done well.
It's a wonderful asset for the school. Great. Thank you, Bob.
Motion.
All right. Any other board reports? No? All right. Thank you. Discussion items. First item for your discussion is the 21st Century Classroom Furniture and Equipment Bid Results. And as you know, we've been talking about setting up a couple model classrooms in each of our buildings in order for us to begin to do several things. But for this particular report, really looking at the kind of furniture that ultimately we might be wanting to use in our classrooms, where flexible groupings can be established more readily, where we don't have an environment where there's a desk for every child necessarily, but a seat for every child, and utilizing the space we have with the furniture that will allow us to do so, and equipment that that we may need. Obviously, the second leg of that, the most important leg of that, is the instructional practices that accompany that are not necessarily all whole group, that are project-based, that are geared towards individual learners around similar concepts. And so we see the next few years is our ability to tap the teachers who have volunteered to be in these rooms with some experimental furniture, but also some experimental practices.
Mm-hmm. Will we be taking, or developing rather, a feedback tool for teachers?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be developing that with them.
Right, that's what I thought. But just to, you know, we do, I think, typically a really good job of collecting that, so it's both going to be qualitative, certainly, but also quantitative in terms of what they see, etc.
Can you,
give it that title.
Yeah. Are there any questions?
Well, and the furniture won't be available until the. I thought we talked about like.
Well, until you approve. So we can't.
If it gets approved, it won't be available until December. But
probably late October.
Will there be some. We need to talk about different instruction as well. Is that going to start immediately, or is that going to wait?
for the current year?
Well, I'm sure these teachers are already doing some things differently. To accompany that, we have a study group as part of our long-range plan that's looking at a kind of a think tank group that's been put together this year to look at project-based learning. And so whether we implement that new approach in those rooms or whether we'll find a pilot school is yet to be determined. But these are teachers who are already doing some things a little bit differently.
The two for school that we're done with?
They gave us lots of pictures here, and I had a question on, so is this, you know, are these ideas, or is this what we're trying to do in the classroom?
Well, the furniture are the samples of the furniture that we will be purchasing,
but
the arrangements are just... They are not necessarily what any of our classrooms would look like. Those are just, they come out of whatever. The classroom that experimented with the furniture last year probably looked a little bit more like the, if you looked at it, it doesn't have a page, 64. If you looked at page 64, the whole classroom, it's a much larger classroom than this teacher had, but... probably looked a little bit more like this setup than any of the others. But each classroom is a little different based on size, based on the grade level. But the idea is to be able to create individual groupings for different purposes. So
I'm just trying to tie these numbers, right? We're going to have, you know, 200 of this or whatever to... what are we trying to do? I mean, I understand conceptually what you're trying to do, but are we... putting one of these classrooms in every school? Are we putting
two in every school?
Two in every school. And are they going to be different configurations? Or
they'll be the configurations that the teachers design with the furniture. And they had input into the selections of the furniture.
It could change week to week. It could change day to day.
Like this SmartLink student desk really looks uncomfortable.
Well, the kids used it last year.
And they liked it.
The furniture was...
road tested.
It was road tested with students at Lincoln, first grade group at Lincoln, and the other grade came down and played with it as well.
I guess the thing
actually, those desks are pretty comfortable. If you look at the chair that goes with it, which has a little bit of movement, has the ability to sit differently on it, different...
For all grades? I mean, even a fifth grader is going to be comfortable on the Hokie stool?
Well, the Hokie stool might not. We have the Hokie stools for the intermediate students. And whether or not, you know, as we move on from this, whether every class would have Hokie stools or not is yet to be determined. The primary kids love them. And again, the nice thing about them is that they have the ability to move. They're not so, you know, static.
Than what my son refers to as his fidget thing.
Yeah. It allows everyone to have a fidget.
But don't a lot of these, I mean, I'm just looking at some of these beanbags. I mean, a lot of these classrooms, the teachers have one in there, and they're like reading area. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's already some of those types of things that teachers have been using.
These are a little bit more industrial.
Right.
Which will make them last a little longer. Anyway.
They
haven't. Yeah, I guess the thing I would like to throw out just to think about, I think we talked about one time, let's just take a classroom and let's just do what we need to do top to bottom, make it 21st century, you know, so the difference of spending, you know, whatever, $60,000 with little things we're going to do to improve versus let's just take the classroom, let's go for it, let's knock down the wall, let's put the setting that we want in it, to really kind of test the whole concept.
Well, our goal...
That might be more, that might turn into the Hadley thing, but...
The goal is to add to these classrooms each year. We painted them as well in the color scheme that school will ultimately have, and they'll be carpeted in the little carpet area that we would eventually have. There's lighting, there's windows that we would eventually look at, and of course technology, which will be an evolving piece for those classrooms. Again, we're limited a little bit by space,
So you're experimenting within the space that you have, which would ultimately be where we'd see ourselves going anyway. And as the curriculum, as we look at that project-based approach to our curriculum, then that will help facilitate further changes. So I think, John, that's our intent, but not all at once. Like one classroom all at once, but to build those classrooms in each of the schools.
I think in the money being spent, there was part of our renewal process anyway. It wasn't like throwing out furniture we bought a year ago.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is, to your point, that, right? I'm just going back to this concept that we had talked about.
Do one all at once.
You know, if we build and build and build and build and eventually it's there, it's like, you know, is that the right strategy versus just taking one and, you know, taking four classrooms and making them into the 21st century that we're thinking, with the breakout room and all the other things and the right furniture. And this way, at least we have, you know, something we can pilot in its entirety, learn from, and give the folks in the community a chance to see what it is, mm-hmm. right?
We could explore that at any one of these classrooms or schools. If you take four classrooms and create breakouts, you would have to give consideration to portables, unless we do it at a school where we've got empty space at this point.
Yeah, again, I don't know if it's 4, 2, 3, 5, whatever.
Because that would require, as you said, taking down walls. Now a classroom, some classroom is probably going to be displaced at least to some level.
Given our facility situation, I'm happy with what we're doing.
Yeah.
I want to reinforce something that Sam just brought up, because I made myself a note that to tie into that, this is a step, to John's point, there's different iterations of this, but I think this is, and you had talked about this when you first brought it up, just a great opportunity for teachers, students, and community, certainly parents, but also community members, to see what we talked about 2 years ago in the visioning and what the Master Facilities Planning Committee also talked about, which is bringing the outside in, the inside out, you know, being able to create space. The furniture here, as we've even looked at special education IEP needs in classes, when I would attend CERC meetings over at Churchill, one of the things the teachers were asking for were some of what Dan just described, which are those seat cushions that are fidget cushions, because more than just the students who might need that with an IEP seem to respond to that more positively in terms of their ability to concentrate, et cetera, those kind of things instead of a hard seat. So I feel like we have, this is all, for me, again, communication, that this is a starting point, and it really, we already have teachers doing creative changes in the classroom, the way they teach, et cetera, with the furniture we have, and this is that next step to visualize it for people to have a more tactile, you know, connection to it. So, you know, I don't know if any of us got over to Lincoln. I just did once last year to kind of peek in the classroom, and it definitely changes the tone in the room. And so I think it's a great starting point.
So, Andy, I know you said Lincoln was first grade and third grade. Or is that
first and third, I think?
Yeah. But the question is, not every school has first and third grade.
No. Some have second and fourth.
Area, so yeah. We can figure
yeah.
out.
Yeah, some have second and fourth. Yeah. I don't know if there's a fifth grade class. Oh, yeah. Fifth grade at Forest Glen? No.
Franklin,
fifth grade. Fourth grade and second grade at
Well, not that I'm asking about, yeah. I mean, every grade is
yeah.
represented if we're going.
Yeah. Except I don't think we have kindergarten.
They already have grade phones. It's a company. Any other comments? So this will come up at our September 12th meeting.
Correct. Next item on the agenda is the transfer of funds from the Education Fund to the Debt Service Fund, and this is an annual requirement for you, and it's based on our lease, our debt service, and in several of the leases that we have, and this is just a requirement by law that we need to go through.
Some questions, comments? Okay. And again, this is for our September 12th meeting.
Thank you.
The next item is also a compliance item in terms of establishment of fund balance classifications from the Government Accounting Standards Board, GASB, which you have seen before in other numbers. This is GASB 54, and this is just reestablishing some really nomenclature around funds and how those funds are to be identified. And so this is something that we have worked with our auditors on and our attorneys have reviewed, but again, it's something that we are required to be in compliance with. You will see this appear in our CAFR report next year, but not in our annual financial document that we send to the state. So we don't send it to the state. We don't use that process for the state, but we'll use it for our kind of our communication vehicle, which is our CAFR. Any questions on that? Thank you. Next item is the Hadley Security System update. We are looking to add cameras, replace some cameras, and add some cameras at Hadley in areas that we've been able to determine are areas that need some additional eyes. And so we're suggesting that we add cameras to Hadley for a cost of one-time cost of $20,344.69 and an ongoing cost of $2,792. I want to acknowledge that Steve had asked a question at our last meeting about using a different kind of approach, and he and Mike have been in communication about that other approach, which is not tied to the servers. And I don't know, Steve, do you want to talk a little bit about it, and I'm going to have Mike further explain it, or just have Mike give our kind of recommendation?
I understand the recommendation is less expensive for given what we have installed. It's just technology moving towards IP cameras, and you know, at some point there might, it's like the VCR versus a DVR. You know, and you can probably buy a cheap VCR right now, but there's reasons why you wouldn't get it, you know.
Right.
But you know, just it'd be nice if we piloted something as long as we were there, and just to get an idea, you know, when we do, and that we have a plan 5-10 years out to you know, where we want to be with this. You know, if there's things we can do in terms of those cameras and being able to individually access them and other things like that that maybe you can't do with the current system.
We currently, I mean, in terms of quality of the cameras and what we're suggesting is going to be the same quality as it would be if we went to an IPA.
Right.
And we do not have someone who monitors those cameras. You know, they really are just cameras that are
right
there, and if we need them, we use them. So some of the, we're not at this point needing that kind of technology. We also are paying for the servers that we currently have, and so
right,
we don't feel at this point it's worth making an additional expenditure to.
And that's fine. I'm just, you know, down the road, you know, an IP camera you can bring up on your cell phone, theory,
right,
or something, or,
right,
you know, be able to address it, move it, if it had a motor, or focus it, things like that.
And I think, you know, Mike has talked in his long-range plan that it certainly makes sense to probably move in that direction when we have finished paying for the current servers that we have.
I know I had some questions on, there was a clause in there that said you can't pay 90% of the remaining service. I can't find that language in this packet or this attendance, so I didn't know if you guys figured that out or got rid of it.
No, I missed that question. I just thought you were rough, but I can follow up with her.
Yeah, we'll have an answer to that.
And you said this is for 5 years? Is this 5 years or three?
I believe that was five. Is that five now? And this is just, I believe this is just an hourly purchase, correct?
Yeah.
This is not a lease.
No,
the ongoing maintenance.
It's an hour, 5 years.
It's
five years.
Yeah.
Okay. So I just saw they had a term and condition that said for the first 3 years they agreed to honor the service charge. For the first three, so versus it said it was going to be
for five. So we'll check that out to see. Do you understand the question?
Yeah. I didn't know if that means what it, they incremented the inflation for 3 years.
Well,
or the war, you know, the important thing is just the war.
Thank you, Dan. Mm-hmm. Anything else? And this is for the 12th of September as well. Next item, final item for discussion, is the Hadley parking lot and stormwater project that we are proposing for next year. And this has been to Finance Committee. And basically, it's a very large project to remove the above-ground stormwater detention at Hadley, reconfigure the parking lot and paving, and put underground stormwater detention there. It's a very big project. We're asking to move it forward for this year because next summer the village of Glen Ellen will be resurfacing Hawthorne. And so to be able to do two rather large construction projects at the same time, while it would be a disruption to homeowners around that area, would be less of a disruption than if you do one and then we come back to you in a couple of years and say, can we do the Hadley project now? So we're trying to coordinate with the Village of Wheaton, Village of Glen Ellen, and get this project done because it is on our long-range capital projects plan. And it is a major project that must be done at some point. It's a large project. We're bringing it to you early because in order to get all of the required engineering and required permits that need to be secured from both the Village of Glen Ellen and the City of Wheaton, it's just going to require a timetable that's a lot more aggressive and sooner than we would normally do for a capital project. So open for discussion on that.
Do we save money by doing it?
Well, that's my question. Is in theory, for the village, that they have, you know, they have heavy equipment there from some vendor that, you know, it's less. They can keep it there for a couple more days and take care of the parking lot.
It's possible. We can't at this point, and we really haven't even entered into discussions with anyone until you give us your approval to move the project forward at least to bid.
You were moving this up based on that you thought
the partnering
with, or that you thought that it was
the potential to save money could be there. I can't make a guarantee or say that that is a definite. When we did the Bun Franklin stormwater, you know, we looked at that as a means of partnership. When we were going to do some work at Ben Franklin and the village was going to do some work, we partnered with them and they paid for the landscaping in front of Ben, you know, so that opportunity is there. We just can't say at this point how extensive that opportunity might be.
Also, the application per, the application process for stormwater, time is of the essence there because it's a protracted process. I just can't walk in and start to sit down and discuss with the City of Wheaton as well as the Village of Glen Ellen stormwater applications unless we do some forecasting in terms of projections from the engineers. Mm-hmm.
So if you remember our Ben Franklin project, which really unfolded over a course of about a year and a half.
But I guess the question is, Hadley wasn't being worked on, and we still, when would we have thought about doing something?
In the next couple of years. If not
this
year,
this
is on our roadmap.
Forward.
Right. This year.
If we'd like to understand, you know, is there an opportunity to save by doing that, mm-hmm. or is it something we could do 2 years from now and it would cost the same?
Mm-hmm. I just say it's what we'd like you to look into opportunities.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, we brought that up in the last conversation. What was the cost sharing? And you said the same thing. We don't know until the issue for you is, are we comfortable enough with this project, which is a large expenditure, to move forward and begin our exploration? And that means prepare documents that would allow us to go out to bid.
Can you elaborate more on the storm? Is the stormwater one of those things that we have an opportunity since we're working on this area, or is there a requirement that we have to do something with the stormwater?
Every time we touch the exterior of our buildings or one of our parking lots, it triggers a stormwater calculation. That's part of the intergovernmental agreement that we have with the village of Glenelg. So, like we had to go through sort of the same process when we've just done the Ben Franklin and the Lincoln parking lot. However, we made an agreement. We agreed to not materially affecting those areas. In other words, it was a one-for-one replacement. This is something that would take it a step further. And so this would more than likely trigger some stormwater calculations. There have been issues in the Hadley area for a number of years regarding stormwater. And it will also allow us to move from above ground detention to underground detention to maximize green space and so forth on that property area.
So when you say the calculations show that it triggers, is it because of the new proposed layout?
Mm-hmm.
There's more, I guess, non-green space area, which is why it triggers it. So we could, in theory, have a configuration that leaves the stormwater as is, but still does what repairs are needed to the existing parking lot.
Well, the repairs are essentially complete replacement because the substructure of that lot is so old and so deteriorated. There's not a lot of work we could do, you know, doing it piecemeal. That's why we're recommending that we take the project as a whole.
But if you did it, I mean, just, okay, so then say I have to redo the whole parking lot as is. If I take the existing parking lot, tear it down to bedrock, build it back up.
But leave the above ground detention as it is.
Right.
So you're only replacing the existing parking lot. You're not doing the additional work, which is to remove that detention.
We would guarantee a one-for-one replacement in that case.
And it would be less money, is that what you're asking? Or it wouldn't require stormwater?
Yeah, so if you don't have to do stormwater, you know, there was the $15,000 there, some engineering, there's the $200,000, plus excavation, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some portion of a chunk of this project. And I'm not just, I mean, part of it is the money, but when I look at, and I, you know, on finance committee, we got some drawings. I don't know if you guys have seen proposed layouts. But when I printed out the Hadley one, I also have some questions about traffic flow in terms of, we have a system now, and, you know, I don't have a kid at Hadley, never done this, but I see a drop-off, what I call a designated drop-off area.
Mm-hmm.
I see a parking area. Now with the new ones I'm seeing, they kind of combine, where now you have people dropping off also going to the parking lot. So, you know, is there potential for now that drop-off gets slowed down because it's got to wait for people to pull out?
There's an administrator out there personally handling traffic in the morning.
And then also the way this looks at, I don't, you know, I got a plan option. I got an option 3B and an option 5. I don't know which one we're currently looking at.
3B.
So, you know, whenever they go through the drop-off, before they could exit back onto Hawthorne, now it looks like they have to go all the way to
Glencoe.
Is that now put increased traffic on that street? You know, have we gotten feedback from residents on that?
Having had children there, and it, I mean, it's a great point, because if you haven't navigated that, it's hard to envision it. I would describe it as being in a pinball machine, because when you do drop, if you drop your child off in the front, when buses are dropping off, they're coming down Hawthorne toward Glencoe and up Glencoe into that one turn into the parking lot while cars are coming down, putting themselves in two lanes to either turn right on Hawthorne or left on Hawthorne. So there's a period of about 20 minutes, maybe 25 minutes, every morning and every afternoon, where I think it's an incredible safety hazard. And part of it is the fact that you can't see, because we have the bushes and the fencing around the detention, so there's not line of sight. So one of the things I know we talked about before, I mean, it's great questions, and if you haven't been through it, it's hard to understand why we would want to move people through, straight through and back onto Glencoe. There's much less traffic over there in the morning than there is on Hawthorne in the morning. And so that's one issue for me. And the other is, and I don't remember how much detail the Master Facility Planning Steering Committee went into, but there was a group that looked at safe passage around the schools and where we have some hot spots and that type of thing. And I will tell you, even just from 6 years of PTA Council, the safety chair has always identified that, has gone to the village of Glen Ellen to work out having a paid, you know, like we do on Geneva for Churchill, et cetera. So it's been an ongoing concern, and in some ways I think we've been fortunate that we do have a, you know, physical administrator out there, whether it's Dr. Dranzoff or Matt Edelman goes out there now or whomever. So it does look like it's all converging, but what's happening now is we have two, and they're all coming together in one spot every day.
I mean, see multiple options with the existing versus the current. You're now funneling people through, and so
I haven't had a chance. I mean, I haven't seen it. And that was going to be one of my questions. Was is there any thought why, you know, when we looked at building the grade level center? I mean, we addressed that was one of the big issues that Bob did a great job addressing with the residents in that area was the increased traffic and the talk of changing the buses and moving them out onto the property. Do we have an opportunity to do that with this? Or
yes, we would be looking to move hopefully the buses along Glencoe. We have met with obviously the architects and engineers, myself. We have met the village of Glen Ellen as well as the police have even had input on this also. And we've discussed this at length in terms of redeveloping the whole front approach, and everyone is in agreement, general agreement, something, if we have the opportunity to address it, that we should.
But the question, Bob, was, would we be able in this solution,
right.
Because the Hadley Grade Level Center had the cutout into the property where it was a bus lane. We're not talking about that.
Well, and I haven't seen it,
it's pretty much the same, a little area where the flag is and the
okay.
You're getting rid of that, but you basically come in and.
A cleaner approach.
Cleaner
egress.
Going
in the same direction.
And to me, that's a detail that we're, you know, we can ask questions about. And I don't have a problem moving forward with this to take a look at it, to take that next step without. I feel it's important for us to take the next step rather than lose any kind of opportunity. And we can, after it's gone and some of the plans are drawn up and we have more discussion about it, it's like anything. We can say yes, we can say no, we can say can you look about it, you know, in a different way. And I think I would hate for us to miss an opportunity to take the next step and then not, you know, and not know. And John, and I agree, if there's no cost savings and we don't have to do it right now, maybe it's something that we have to wait on, but I just hate to see it.
I think maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, Dan, but I think part of the question is if we're going to spend $800,000, is this where we want to spend it, right?
Because, that's the question.
You know, again, sound like a broken record, but if I were going to spend that kind of money and I could do that 21st century classroom and do it in such a way, you know, that might be a priority for me. I think that's the question here.
Well,
want to waste their time in putting this together, go getting bids, go have all these meetings, and then if it comes back, we're like, let's just wait.
Right. Now, and I think that's maybe a good example because these are projects that are on our capital improvements that go out 20 years, and, you know, we look at needing about $1 million each year towards capital projects, which are keeping our properties and our facilities at a high level given the challenges that we have with aging facilities. So this is one of those pieces that we can do it now, we can do it later, but we have to do it because the parking lot is crumbling. So it is a question of, you could say, well, I'd rather you put it into this and not into that. And I would then probably follow up to say, how long are you willing to live with that? You know, a parking lot that is not safe, and, you know, it's not safe for employees, it's not safe for kids who walk across it because it's starting to show, you know, have that kind of deterioration. I think part of the question is, you know, we've talked about roofs and that sort of thing coming down the line. Maybe another piece of this question is how can we look at the whole economic picture and say, how do we fund this part of our facility work against the other work that we want to do? Now, it's possible that that's a good retreat topic. As we, on September 5th, when we talk about master facilities and that goal, is to maybe have some of that conversation. Mm-hmm. This would allow us to, you know, if you recognize that the parking lot needs to be repaired at some point, and this perhaps would be a timely opportunity for us, that we'll begin to, we're going to ask you to give us permission to move forward, not to approve anything, not to come to you with a final decision on a layout, because I think there is still a lot of work and a lot of conversation to be had about the parking lot and whether underground detention or whether it's the right configuration of getting, you know, people in and out. Mm-hmm. I think that those are still conversations that have to be had.
Right. Mike, I would like to know, basically, you know, if we do take the chance to do underground detention while it's all done, does that buy us you know, room to do building on other parts of the site where we can mm-hmm. point to detention that's there?
Increased detention.
In theory, let's say we had to put in 10 permanent classrooms and you took out all those portables.
Right.
If you just had paved the current parking lot, you'd have to go put in some kind of underground detention. Whereas if we did that now, we basically don't have to worry about underground detention if we did some kind of building
mm-hmm.
in the future
mm-hmm.
or we paved
mm-hmm.
something over there.
This is a step that is inevitable.
That would be less to do it then
right,
than
right.
to do it later under a building or something else.
Which is similar to what we did at Franklin.
Well, right. Whereas to say, I mean, I didn't even know for the three classrooms we put in, what was the cost of the small underground detention we put in for that?
About $120,000.
Right, just for the three classrooms. Whereas, I guess it would be nice to know if we did put some kind of underground detention under this new parking lot, what does that buy us, in theory,
mm-hmm.
to build
mm-hmm.
in terms of square footage?
Mm-hmm.
That detention that we put in for those three classrooms, though, that was for the three classrooms, but
mm-hmm.
also deficiencies from previous buildings.
Right.
Okay.
Which finally brought us up to that magic number that the village was willing to accept.
So it would be a good question to ask, what would it take to further our detention capacity?
Well, it's just, you know, I don't want to be penny-wise, pound-foolish.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't want to just needlessly spend money on anything. I can tell you the neighbors around there are going to, it's a benefit to have more underground detention.
Sure.
I mean, I can tell you before the forest, or the Ben Franklin went in, the neighbors down at the corner of Bryant or whatever said there was basically, wood chips from Ben Franklin that would just load out there all
mm-hmm.
the time.
It was always like a little river. Yeah.
I
was thinking the same thing, Steve, in my head is you know, being smart about how we can maximize construction, et cetera, that's always already going on. And I asked Dan the question this morning, do we know, of cost sharing or ways that we could, you know, work with the village to do that? So that's, you know, Ann and Bob know that that's on our mind. I think what I'm hearing Bob tell us from his investigation is that there's not a choice to leave the parking lot for more than another year in terms of what you find, or two. So that is on the list of have to
mm-hmm.
eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're really talking about is, do we then push out to again, utilize a neighborhood that's already going to be pulled apart for sewage, et cetera, and open up opportunities for us further down the road with detention done? And we've already had this experience, so this is not a new process for the district. We've been doing this in terms of trying to leverage that anyway. So if I understand it, the, you know, cost and information under additional cost and information on our attachment says there this pre-project cost of $15,000, which are a part of the professional fees, not on top of those, but they'll get sunk into the $95,000. So on September 12th, when we come back and we
have a final discussion and then, you know, move forward on this one way or the other, or not move forward. That's what you're asking us to do, is to initiate so you can do the investigation for us to answer whatever questions we have, correct?
Correct.
Well, I see on the 12th that's approval to go out to bid, and after that is reviewing.
Is that correct, Bob? No?
No, we're just looking, I'm looking for support from the board to begin the initial investigative work in terms of what this project will entail, what the potential costs are, what the application procedures will be with regards to the city of Wheaton and the building of Rhode Island. I'm looking to begin those, gather that initial information. That's the $15,000.
So that we could prepare bids?
That's correct.
To bring back?
Can't walk the bid until we do this preliminary work.
Mm-hmm. Is this still, with the economy the way it is, a better time to be going out to bid on large projects like this? Are you finding that we're still getting a better bid?
We've been very successful in the past 2 years with regards to our pricing. There's been quite a bit of disparity from the high to the low bid, sometimes as much as $600,000 or $700,000, and I would anticipate this type of situation. We're going to get numbers all over the board, but we've been very satisfied with the quality of work from our best bidders the past couple of years. I would expect the same type of situation to occur.
I want to speak to Dan's comment. If you look on the timeline that you have put, it does say prepare Board of Action approval to go to bid. Would it be more accurate, Bob, to say prepare research for bids?
Yes.
So if we change that, maybe that's a little bit more clear in terms of what we'll be doing between now and that December date or November date, getting the research done so that the bids could come to you in a timely manner in November.
Mm-hmm. Well, December is typically when we go out the bid with a recommendation starting in January to walk through that process.
Right, so we would be bringing bids in November for the discussion approval process.
Yes, yes.
The process.
So what will we be voting on?
The concept of allowing us to move forward to engage in engineering investigation.
That would be just the 15 grand.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't feel comfortable going out and just spending $15,000 on doing this without your... It's such a large project that we felt without your willingness to do that, we would be doing an investigation without your approval for a very large project.
Well, I guess that's one of my questions on the stormwater system. You know, I think it'd be appropriate to see an option for a new, improved traffic layout that does not require a stormwater system to be touched. And that would, I guess whoever did these layouts here could conceivably do something similar. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we would want to do both.
Right. But you're saying to you know, kind of split this project so one is...
To have an alternate to move
forward.
Not
necessarily, just as Bob said, if we did a one for one, we can leave the stormwater as is, and then that would free up that money to instead of just do 8 classrooms, that'd be 16 or 24 classrooms.
Right. But part of the conversation, though, is what Steve brought up, which is the conversation around why correct the detention now. You know, what are we gaining in the future if we're going to be building or doing some other things on that property?
When would we get the answer to that?
To the question
of what we're gaining.
What do you mean when what we're gaining?
On doing the detention.
Right.
Steve's question about what's the
separate
what does this allow for?
Steve's question is, what would we need to do to gain, do we get anything if we do underwater detention, taking the current detention pond, and whatever else we would have to add for building more hardscape? The next question is, what would it take to get us to 10 additional classrooms or something?
How much would that buy us?
That's a different question, I think.
Yeah. Oh, mine was just, I'm under the impression we touch anything with permanent building and it triggers some kind of underground detention.
Correct.
No matter what.
Or some kind of detention.
Right.
For us, it would have to be underground.
We're not going to put a big pit in to have it that, is it more cost effective to do it while, you know, the equipment's there, the parking lot's being worked on. But now we have options if, you know, we ever do need to add on to Hadley, you know, at a minimum, put 10 permanent classrooms in where we have 10 portables.
So really what we're asking you to give approval to in the next meeting would be to move forward with that engineering, that research, and be able to bring back to you more formed recommendation and bid products for you to examine. It would allow us to, in that time, to look, work with the village to see if there's any way we do a joint bidding process to conserve costs. We can ask them to investigate as a parallel what would be the difference between just keeping, you know, the stormwater as is, which is that detention area, and just redo our hardscape, our current.
So it sounds like you need that to answer our question today. Right?
Well, except for the bid product part, that's what I understand is why we would need that level of detail before we decide which option we're going to go. Because usually you don't want to do that until after you have chosen the direction you're
going to go. So how much money is this going to take? What you want to do?
You're talking about not doing any engineering.
No, the bid documents. Thought you said...
Well, the bid documents won't come until after you've done the engineering study. Because you really don't know. It's possible you could do the engineering study and the cost would be prohibitive from that engineering study and decide, this is not something we can do.
No, I'm okay with that.
Okay.
I just want to make it understand in my head the timing. Because, you know, if the design fees are $80,000 and I saw in the document that we get charged 50% up front, so I just want to understand this.
Before we go.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What we'll do is bring back to you our progress report once we've had the engineering report and give you a status so that you can see. And whether we could do it for the whole board or we could just bring it back to finance. I mean, that's, you know.
So that would be...
I don't know about you. It would probably be after September.
Because, 6 weeks.
Yeah, because the permitting, the whole investigative process is going to be larger than just the engineering. It is going to be the permitting, the connecting with both the village of Glen Ellen and Wheaton for the project. And,
but that occurs after.
Well, not necessarily. There are some things that would have to take place now in order to have that groundwork laid. If we wait, you don't know what kind of roadblocks you're going to run into. So you may say, yeah, go forward with the project while we're on a bid, and then we run into a buzzsaw with either the village of Glen Ellen or Wheaton. So, I mean, engaging in conversations right now are important.
I know the village last week had their workshop, and they had a large discussion on the width of the street.
Mm-hmm.
They had about an hour of local resident input, and I think they ultimately decided to go with the...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what their full timeline is in terms of when they're going to finally just, you know, they haven't approved it yet. They just gave
right.
a recommendation now and go back.
Right. We're in similar stages, really, in the whole project. That's why it's important for us to try to move, if we're going to move forward in sync a little bit, so that if we can take up advantage of any opportunities for joint bidding, that we would be able to do so.
And when, in terms of the time, you know, like I think that on the Forest Glen parking lot,
we had to do a public hearing.
When do we? What's the general timing on this one?
Public hearing would be until next spring.
Yeah. After you've gotten your bid documents and prior to approving the go ahead.
I guess that information would be more helpful to me when we choose the option, because by then you've already bid. You already have a plan all ready to go. To me, it'd be more helpful to get that feedback when we're deciding which way to go. So that would be...
And get the feedback from the community that
right.
lives around there in
right.
terms of the layout of the plan?
Right.
Oh, and I think that's possible to hold. Mm-hmm. We might not do a public hearing at that time, but we could certainly hold a community forum.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that's...
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever...
Well, and it may raise, Dan, some issues from parents with children at the school around safety concerns and
mm-hmm.
maybe support for this, those
and traffic
kind
flow.
Of issues,
yeah,
traffic flow,
absolutely.
All that type of thing.
Yeah.
When's our next survey going out?
Spring.
In
springtime.
Do you like the parking lot pattern at Hadley? If you could change it, how would you change it?
Oh, dear. That would be comment sections, and we have to go through all those different suggestions by hand.
140 characters.
But we certainly, I mean, we've done that before, had neighborhood, you know.
Yeah, and have him, you know, announced and then had neighbors come to hear the presentation, et cetera. You know, it's hard to respond to something that's not tangible, and so I think this process is important so that people have something to respond to and not just a what-if scenario. I mean, that, I think that makes us look less organized in our approach, so it's important.
Is there any further information that board members need from us before request to take action on September 12th?
Upcoming meetings of the board include September 7th, a special meeting at 5 p.m. here at the Central Services office, and September 12th, a regular meeting at 7:30 p.m. again here at the Central Services office. Are there any other matters to be considered by the board? Are there any members of the public who wish to address the board at this time? The board has determined it has a need to adjourn to closed session to discuss collective negotiating matters between the district and its employees or their representatives, or deliberations concerning salary schedules for one or more classes of employees, and the purchase or lease of real property for the use of the district, including meetings held for the purpose of discussing whether a particular parcel should be acquired. May I have a second?
Second.
Roll call, please.
Yes.
Mr. Bondra?
Yes.
Powers?
Yes.
Mr. Black?
Yes.
Mr. Allen?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mr.
Kenley?
Yes.
Mr. Johnson? Yes. The board will not be taking action when it returns from closed session. Thank you very much.